Hello, Own Your Career Podcast and Acceleration Nation. On today's podcast, I have a great guest, Newton Chang. He is a director at Google focusing on mental and physical health. And this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. Many of you have heard, I've dealt with a few different bouts of depression and anxiety throughout my career. I have not always been forthcoming with it. I've been more forthcoming over the course of time. But Newton Chang is someone who is very public with it, which is great because people need to understand what challenges exist. And you're not alone with your battles with depression, with imposter syndrome, with anxiety, with all the stress in life, work, kids, family, job security, everything like that. As a quick reminder, if you are looking for a better job with more money and at a better company, we can help you here at Kadima Careers. We help you three different ways. We have a digital course that shows you exactly what to do with all the scripts and templates and worksheets. We offer group coaching, where you work with a community, you work with me, you work with our amazing, talented community of coaches to help you get that better job. And for a small select group of individuals, we work with you on a personalized basis where we guarantee to get you a better job. We only take 20 to 30 people in per month for that. But for all these, go to our website, kadimacareers.com, and you can follow me on LinkedIn where I post daily. So with that, listen to this great episode with me and Newton Chang. And the last three words I'll leave you before this episode starts, own your career. Hello, Acceleration Nation, and welcome to another episode of the Own Your Career podcast, formerly known as A Steer Your Career with Kadima, the Sick Career Podcast. New name, same great stuff. We are talking today to Newton Chang. He is a director of health and performance at Google. The way I got in touch with Newton is because of our newly hired amazing head of operations, Darcy Rubel. She told me when she joined Kadima that I got to get Newton on the podcast. And a few weeks later, we have Newton on the podcast here to share some of his wisdom, insights, and career path. So with that, Newton, I'd love to have you introduce yourself to the Own Your Career podcast community.
Hi, everyone. My name's Newton Chang, and the way I describe myself, I think of myself in three big parts. One, I'm a family man. So I'm a husband and then father to two wonderful daughters. I am a world champion competitive powerlifter. I have won multiple national and world titles and set multiple national and world records in powerlifting in the master's class, and that's 40 and over. And I most recently just won the open class for US nationals, and which means I beat everyone at every age. So the 45-year-old guy took down the 20-year-old kids. And
you go.
I think everyone loves an underdog, so it was love all around, but I'm continuing to climb on that journey. The third part is that I am a leader in health and performance in the workplace. During the day, I am a director of health and performance at Google, where I oversee a suite of their amenities that are there to support the physical, mental, social, and spiritual health of our Google community. And then beyond that, I spend a lot of my time doing talks, interviews, workshops, and podcasts talking about my own mental health journey and trying to be a visible mental health advocate to just pierce through the stigma we all have around mental health, because so many are struggling right now, both in the workplace and beyond.
And that's so important, Newton. I myself have struggled with some mental health challenges. In my first 6 months at Google, it was really painful for me, despite getting $62,000 more than my compensation at American Express, despite getting to wear jeans to work finally, when I didn't get to wear those at American Express, despite getting free food and bring my dog to work. I had significant imposter syndrome. I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I thought I was just a miserable failure. And my first 6 months at Google were some of the worst time in my life, despite all of those positive attributes. I didn't know who to go to. Fortunately, my wife's a doctor, and I have a friend who's a psychiatrist. So I had those resources in and around me. But if I didn't, things could have been a lot worse. That being said, how do people at Google or people that you work with know about what's available to them and to take advantage of some of these things? Because I didn't know back in 2011. And it was only because of my wife and my friend, who's a shrink, that I like started to get the support that I needed. But I'd love to hear what you've built at Google, what Google has, what other, like how people can navigate this as the stress of work is only getting tougher.
It's interesting. So the year 2011, that was around the time frame where a grassroots effort started at Google of people saying, hey, we need to start talking more openly about mental health. At the time, I was completely undereducated on the topic and didn't have really good awareness of my own mental health. But a few things happened. One, the employees started something called the Mental Health Conference. And it was just this grassroots conference where they would have talks relating to mental health, whether those be more academic or technical, or talks where employees were openly sharing their stories around things like depression, anxiety, bipolar. And so right from there, people were putting the stories out there and humanizing them. The other big critical thing that happened was that one of our VPs, Daryl Heinrich, actually came forward with his story around struggles with depression, and it intertwined with his climb at Google. And so when that story came out, Google, to their credit, they ran with it. They said, you know what, this is a really important story. We're going to send an email to the entire company. We're going to bake this into our manager trainings. We're going to make a animated video on this so you have a digital asset that's going to live forever and people can reference it. And now fast forward almost 11 years after that, that's when I went on my mental health leave as I was struggling with feelings of burnout. 11 years after I saw that email from Daryl and he described feelings of struggling to get out of bed in the morning, I realized I was feeling the same thing. And so it was 11 years later and that after that seed was planted that I said, oh, that's what Daryl was talking about. Fortunately for me, and probably in contrast to what you're experiencing, there's now like 10 years of work that have been done where the employee assistance program had been built up. Offerings around helping people to learn resilience had been built up. And then all the messaging around how important this is, basic knowledge around mental health, how to access these services, all of those had started to spread out into the ether of Google. So now I don't know the stats around awareness, but it's pretty commonly known that there's very strong support for mental health at Google, both in terms of our willingness to talk about it being a challenge, as well as saying, and we have all of these services available because we know this is a challenge and we want people to take care of themselves.
And Newton, I know you're very open about your mental health challenges and you were burned out, I think, in early 2022 and came back. Would you care like to share a little bit about what was going on with you, what signals you received early on? And
the signals when I first started receiving, or at least recognized the signals, let's dial back to about March 2020, which is the beginning of the pandemic. And if you'll remember what that was like, you know, we went from the world as we knew it to suddenly everything shut down and we're all sent home and we're all living in fear of this new virus. We don't know how much danger we're in and we're really afraid of how much danger our loved ones, especially those who are at risk, might be in. But at that time, and Darcy was on the team at that time, our team were the caretakers. So what we knew is that this was a time of crisis. So we were going to show up and we were going to lean in and lead. So within the span of just, I think, 2 weeks, we took all of our amenities, pivoted them to digital offerings, and sent them so that we could reach Google employees in their homes. We took on more responsibilities across the organization. So this is where Darcy started popping up all over the place, supporting like key efforts. And then we just spent more time checking in with one another because it felt like the right thing to do. And so that was March. Now fast forward to maybe about June. And I remember I was in a meeting with my vice president and his team. We were going around the thumbnails on the video chat, doing a check-in. How are you doing? And when it was about to get to me, a friend sent me a chat message and said, hey, I feel like people are kind of holding back. When it gets to you, say something real. That's a pretty big prompt. And so I thought, okay, what's real for me? Until then, I had been a pretty, you could say maybe a repressed guy where I would try to smile my way through almost anything and say, it's fine, I'll be good. And so for whatever reason, it felt like a dam broke and I started crying. And I said, right now I'm struggling because the number of days that I'm proud of how I'm showing up as a father is going down and I don't know how to turn that around. And so that was, in the moment, it was horrifying for two reasons. One, I was raised and socialized to believe you don't show weakness, you don't show your emotions, you definitely don't do it at work. And so this violated so much of how I was raised as a male in the US, as an Asian American. But the other horrifying thing was I had repressed all that. So I wasn't even willing to admit that to myself. But once I said it out loud, I couldn't unhear it. Like, I knew that's exactly what was going on, and I had to address it. And so I didn't actually take action, though, for much, much longer. So we went into the fall. I took on more responsibilities. In November is when I first started to struggle to get out of bed. And then February is when that story from Daryl, who talked about not being able to get out of bed, that's when it hit, because there was a morning I was overwhelmed with a sense of dread and I couldn't get out of bed. And I realized, that's what Daryl was talking about. I need help.
It was an email like about a decade earlier that you recall reading about?
Yes. Yeah. So 10 years later, that email was stored in like my mental inbox archive and it was still there. And so I went to the employee assistance provider, and the therapist they matched me with said I was showing early signs of burnout. And then fast forward to now the next fall. So it's now fall 2021. A new therapist put me through an intake process and then said, you're exhibiting major symptoms of depression and anxiety. And I was kind of taken aback. Like I said, I know I'm struggling. You know I had seen that email. And so maybe I'm a little depressed, but what do you mean? Isn't this just what it feels like to work hard? And he said, yes, but this is also depression and anxiety. And then the next thing that I said was my big aha of how unaware I was of my mental health. The words that came out of my mouth were, but I've felt like this off and on since high school. And that was my aha of like, oh, this is not the pandemic. This has always been here. And you have just been avoiding it or repressing it or saying this is just the way it is. After that, he diagnosed me with what's called high performing depression or high functioning depression. And what that looks like is, in early November, there was a day where I got up. I'm in a hotel in Costa Mesa, California. I get up while the family's still asleep, like 5 a.m., run down to the lobby. I do compensation planning for my organization of like 60 employees. I run back upstairs. I do childcare. During the same time, I'm dehydrating my body to get prepared for weigh-ins for a world championship in powerlifting. I get the kids ready. I finish the dehydration process. I go to weigh-ins. I make weight for the competition. Immediately after that, I have to start aggressively consuming just the right amounts of electrolyte solution, foods, etc. I go to the competition. I win a world championship. I set a bunch of world records. And then, you know, I go out for a wonderful dinner with my family. And this was all at the height of my depression. So that's what high-functioning depression looks like.
You're breaking records and you're internally depressed.
Yes, because that's what we were raised to do. Like, you know, if you end up in a high-performing place like a Google, or you have the ambitions to say, I'm going to start a company that's going to change people's careers like Kadima, you have to power through a lot of things. And you can steamroll over a lot of negative signals that might be going on, you know, in your mind, your body, your heart. And that's exactly what I was doing.
So this was back in the fall of 2021?
This powerlifting meet was November 2021. I went on leave in January 2022. And honestly, this sounds backwards, but I was trying to time it in a way that worked with the needs of the organization, because I didn't want to let anyone down. I look back and I'm like, well, you were letting yourself down. And because of that, you continued to let your family down.
Did you communicate to your team and the organization while you were leaving? Did you own that narrative, or were you concerned about how that would come out to other people?
I was extremely concerned, but I think this was one of those situations where life hands you the kick in the butt that you need. And so the week after that powerlifting meet, I was scheduled to give a keynote at a health and well-being conference at Google. And so my plan was I was going to talk about all the amazing intersections in the field of health and well-being and with Google technology. But knowing what was going on with me, that just felt completely inauthentic, because I knew how much I was struggling. I knew the data. I knew how much other people, both inside and outside of Google, were struggling. And so if we needed to have a conversation on health and well-being, we should be talking about what's most important, that so many are struggling, and we need to do something about it. So I decided 3 days before the keynote, I'm going to throw the entire thing out. And that's what I'm going to do, is I'm going to talk about what's really going on with me and use this as a call to action for us to, we might not have solutions, but we got to put this on the table and start talking openly about this. Now, what happened once I made that decision, I said, you know what, I'm going to do it. And then I realized, if you do this, your team's going to see this. Your boss is going to see this. Everyone's going to see this. It's going to be recorded. At that moment, I thought, well, I could revert back. Instead, I decided I'm going to lean all the way in. I typed up the keynote. I sent it to my team and said, you're going to hear this from me on Thursday. And I want you to hear it from me first before this audience does. And so it was one of the scariest things I've done in my career, is hit send on that email. Credit to my team. The reason I was able to do it was because I knew it, they would receive it from a place of care. They wouldn't miss a beat and say, we're here for you. And that's exactly what they did.
And then shortly thereafter, you took some time for yourself?
Yeah. So from there, I started working through the process for short-term disability leave. And I went on short-term disability leave for my mental health in January of 2022.
How long did you take to address your mental health?
So the leave was about 7 weeks. In terms of addressing my mental health, that's kind of an ongoing journey. I would say I was ready to get back to work after 7 weeks. And there were a few phases for that. I think once I had gone on leave, I started to realize how important it was for me to just be able to step out of that system, to like change the context I was in. It's kind of like if you had a hamstring injury and you're saying, I'll slow down, but I will not get off the treadmill. Eventually you have to get off the treadmill. And so I got off the treadmill, and then the next phase, people told me, hey, for the first few weeks, don't do anything. Like, you will just need space to let your brain ramp down. And I didn't believe them. And so instead, what I did was, being, you know, an expert in health and well-being, I compiled all the exercises around self-healing that I thought I should be doing. And I put together a regimen that I would go through daily. And after 3 days, what I realized I had done was just created a new job for myself. And it was clear. I'm like, now this self-healing regimen is stressing me out. So I threw that out, and what probably should have taken 2 weeks for me to ramp down, it ended up taking almost 3 weeks. Once I was able to ramp down, it's this wonderful feeling of suddenly all this noise that you thought was you, or you thought it was your active thoughts, you realize it's just noise. And so once the volume went down on that, you realize there is a voice underneath there that is you. And you're like, oh, there you are. Like, I haven't seen you in years. How are you? And that voice is like, I've been here this whole time, pretty haggard. I'd love to reconnect. And so that's where I think the actual healing process started. Once I hear that voice, and I could connect with a few friends from my past who reminded me like what that voice sounded like, you know, before all my achievements and climbing the career ladder.
You're drawing Google back in 2008, coming out of like Haas Business School, right? Berkeley?
Yes.
Like, I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile. You started as a fitness program manager, then workplace service innovation manager, health and performance lead, course facilitator, career and people management coach, and then now you're director of health and performance. So you've always, like, it looks like at your Google tenure for like 15 and a half years or so, you've always been focused on Googler health, performance, mental or physical well-being. Is that like fair assessment?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Before Google, or before Berkeley, I was actually an electrical engineer. I got to help design the PlayStation 3, which sounds really cool on a resume and was really boring in practice, which taught me like, hey, if you find this boring, like, this is probably the coolest project you're going to get. Maybe you should find a new career. And I knew I was always interested in people and helping them take care of themselves so they could live better lives. And so that's why I pivoted into that direction.
For people that want to focus on people and mental health and physical well-being, you wouldn't think that Google would be the primary place to look at for a job. I think they have 180,000 people in the organization. I'm curious how you wind up thinking about Google as a place that you wanted to go to. If you were like trying to pivot away from engineering, how does Google think about the people and productivity? Because they're investing resources on that. You've been there for 15 and a half years. You've led teams of 60 plus people, I think. Why do you choose Google? And talk a little bit about why Google's putting so much emphasis on this area. They're investing in you and your team.
I'll talk about what drew me to Google first, and then I'll talk about kind of the underlying ethos that I would say it's grown to be more than Google. It's across a lot of more progressive companies, especially in technology. So I'll speak in more general terms. But the way I see it is Google has two massive superpowers. One is its technical abilities. The other is its culture. And so when I was looking for jobs, looking in the field of health and well-being, I already knew that so many companies were more proactively investing in the health and well-being of their employees and trying to find ways to support that because it helped them attract good talent, but it also helped them retain and nurture good talent and improve their culture. And so when I was looking for jobs, no one was, you know, more progressive. No one was more radical and experimental in that area than Google. Like one of the stories that you might hear about, I think Susan Wojcicki, who was the CEO of YouTube, she talks about when she first went to tour one of their offices after they moved out of her garage and they were trying to hire her. She's walking around. This was back in the GWC buildings, if you remember those.
I worked in the New York office, so I don't remember all the West Coast buildings.
So it was basically they were crammed into an office that eventually became the corner of campus.
Okay.
But that before was their only building. And she met with Larry and Sergey, and they were already talking about like all the wonderful things that they do to support. So the thing she brings up is like, you have these two guys who are in their late 20s. They're both single, no families. And they're already saying, someday we'll have things like childcare because we'll have a lot of moms working here and working parents, and this will help support them. And so you have like from the DNA of the company thinking pretty radically about how do we take care of employees.
I think they were one of the first companies to provide like free food for employees and like free snacks, or at least at scale, doing it at scale with the micro kitchens. And when I went to Google in 2011 from American Express, I was like, holy cow, this is ridiculous in terms of the resources we have, the massages we get, the food that they give us. It was like Disney World to me.
You know, now if you were to look across tech, there's many companies that have maybe not as robust or large scale amenities, but similar amenities. If I think about the way that companies like Google think about supporting their employees, I think there's this common understanding now that before it was like you treated your employees like you had a work self and then a non-work self. And I could treat you just as like you're an employee. Once you've walked through this threshold, we talk about work. You get your work done. I compensate you, you know, generously. And if we do these two things in partnership, then this could be a really good relationship. I think the rise of companies like Google, it stoked this conversation. You know, whether the early days of massages and ball pits and all the other crazy stuff was, you know, whether that was the right thing to do or not, it started this conversation around, yeah, hey, we are 3D human beings, whether we're in this building or not. And denying that, I don't think it actually helps the work. I think it dehumanizes. And so more companies, I think, are recognizing that. And I think it's a wonderful thing. However, as the world's getting more complex, what you see is more people are willing to put their challenges on the table around things like, I'll start with mental health. That's the topic that's very on trend. People are talking more and more openly about mental health. I said about mental health. There's also a threshold of more people are talking about their mental health, but fewer are up to that point. And then where I'm really trying to push people is to say, yeah, but anxiety and depression, these are symptoms of something else. Like, what's going on here? And so as I get out here and get out there and talk about mental health in the workplace, I'm trying to normalize topics that get a little more scary, like loneliness, like isolation, spirituality. So one of the definitions I like of spirituality from a author, Casper Kyle, he talks about it. He has this framework. It's becoming, belonging, and beyond. So for the path you're walking in life, are you walking a growth path to become someone that you want to be? Do you feel like you belong to others or to a community? And then do you feel like you're part of something beyond yourself? that knits us all together. And if I were to ask you, you know, over a beer, do we need all these things as humans? No one ever says no. Everyone says yes. Now, if I bring it up to you in at the coffee machine in the break room, for some reason, people get antsy and say, well, I don't know. Like, isn't this more about making sure where the incentives are aligned and people have clarity? Yeah, that's important, but I don't think that's at our core.
You talk a lot about loneliness and being not feeling supported. How do you think the return to work, the people working remotely are impacting things? Like, my opinion is I think there's lots of value of people being together. I think there's lots of ways that people can be working remotely too. Like, you and I are talking across the country here. We don't need to be in the same room. But I found going into the offices when I was at Google, the serendipitous encounters, the human touch, the like seeing people that you didn't see, there's value there. How do you think that is coming into play? And like, a lot of people choose to work from home and prefer, or say that they prefer to work from home. Where do you see that plays into the loneliness? Not that you need to be somewhere physically to be together, but it is fairly isolating sometimes to be in your house without leaving all day.
For me, where I am, if you meet me, I get misidentified as an introvert a lot. I'm actually just a tired parent. but if I take Myers-Briggs, I max out the extrovert scale. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, for all those things, the hugs, the smiles, the being able to be with someone, that is super meaningful to me. Because I'm so heavily invested in my career, whether it's good or bad, I've designed a life where being around people, or the opportunity to be around people who share my values, I get a lot of that through work. And so for me, being in person is really, really important. I think where the conversation starts to get challenged is not everyone designed their lives that way. Others have compartmentalized and, to their credit, invested much more heavily in relationships that have nothing to do with work. And as we recently moved from Silicon Valley to Los Angeles, and it kind of gave me this moment to decide, hey, you need to rebuild your relationships in your new community. How do you want to do this? And I've actually taken a more balanced approach to say, yes, I will invest at work. Especially having kids, having a partner, I need to invest a lot more outside of work. And so I'm finding that, like, I still love going to the office, but I am building a much richer life outside the office. And that's leading to a completely different holistic feel around my entire life.
So you're in charge of health and performance at Google. And another thing that I was always amazed with at Google, they used to do a lot of research on making our meetings more productive, Googlers more productive, reducing a lot of the friction that was required there. How have you been able to, and like, I know Google is a very analytical company as well, and they try to figure out how many hours saved or how much money saved or how many meetings saved or things like that. How have some of the efforts of Google's health and performance efforts, like, improve people's performance at work? And like, how do you measure that? Because like, I know Google does that now, especially in tougher economic climate where Google might be a little bit tougher on figuring out how many massage therapists do we need and how much do we need to invest in people's health and wellness? And it's clearly important. How do you quantify that? What sort of questions are you asked by your leadership? And I know the work you do has a lot of impact, but I know at Google, you also have to demonstrate and measure that impact.
If I had to say, like, can I measure this in more valid ways across the population? Because of the time it takes to do that well as in a way that respects privacy, and then you layer, I'll just call it corporate stuff on top of that, doing a really robust study on a Google population around something like that becomes really, really onerous. Mm-hmm. So I'd say for the way that we reference external research a lot and go with the assumption that, hey, Google employees are humans too. Do they reflect the population that this research does? And so we can draw a lot of pretty strong conclusions from that, where it's, mm-hmm. we'd say like, yeah, we're not directly measuring them, but I think we can take a best guess that they track the general population in these ways. Then you look at, okay, if we can help support the behaviors that these studies call out, such as movement, social connection, taking regular rest and recovery, making good food choices, hopefully sleeping adequately. If we can track those things, or not track those things, but offer programs to help support those behaviors, and we show that they're being utilized, and via feedback from the employees, we know that they are experiencing improvement, then we start to have some confidence like, okay, this is moving the needle in the direction we want it to go. Now, you had asked about things like inclusive meetings. I think this gets into a cultural component. And the really interesting thing, and the thing I love about working at a place as progressive as Google, is you can start to call out like the intersectionality of these really big topics like diversity, equity, and inclusion, and health and well-being. And so one thing, like, you know, I've talked about the need for social health and for community. Another way I can think of that or arrive at the importance of that is I was recently in a leadership training where they were talking about running inclusive meetings. And the example they used for showing someone who was not being an inclusive leader was the really dominating leader who was loud and it was their way or the highway. And that's one side of it. But then the thing I called out was to say, hey, that is a problem we need to address. Like, we don't want dominance. I think we also need to recognize that for certain segments, such as women and people of color, depending on your cultural background, you may have been taught implicitly or explicitly to shrink in a meeting setting. And so what are we doing to take all of these wonderful, talented people who may have been taught to shrink and help draw them out into the conversation, because it's going to help them. It's going to help them feel more included, and it's going to help the collective just be smarter, more productive, and more connected. And so that's where I start to see the intersectionality of like, okay, we know we need each other. We know that we need a culture of inclusion, and we know that those things support our ability to do great, awesome work. I don't have like a super clear flow chart of how all this works yet together. You can kind of see like the infinite complexity of the human experience there and like all the wonderful ways that this could come together. And so we keep having those conversations and make sure that we at least recognize, hey, these are things are connected. We got to keep learning.
Well, Newton, this has been a great chat. We're running a little low on time, so I want to finish this up with two last questions. One, so you support the physical, mental, social, spiritual health, and well-being of Googlers. If you were to give advice for Googlers and non-Googlers out there, one last piece of sick career advice on how people can be supported physically, mentally, socially, spiritually, any of the above. What advice would you leave our listeners with?
Mindset I'm experimenting a lot with right now is thinking myself not as an employee of Google, but as a partner to Google. And there's a reason for that. If I think about like, what is my career? It's not just what I do at Google. I own my career. Like, to a note to your podcast, I own my career. It is something I build. Google is a piece of that. Google is an investor in that, as long as our interests stay aligned. Yeah. But ultimately, if I ask the question, hey, would you show up at Google tomorrow if I didn't give you a paycheck? I'd say I'd probably keep coming for the people and the food for a little while, but eventually I wouldn't come back. And then so I'd have to ask like, well, then who are you doing this for? I'm doing this for me. And so I'm a partner to Google. They are my lead investor right now. And as long as our interests stay aligned, like, I think I can do great things for Google and provide them great value. But should our interests diverge, then I should go find a new investor, or they should pull their investment. And that's okay, because it's my career and I'm trying to build it. And if Google's not aligned with what I want my career to be, they're no longer trying to help me build it. They're just giving me money, which is important. And if that's what you need to build your career, then stick with it. But yeah, be clear about that. You are a partner.
Yeah. And if you're not getting the right sort of value in return for the partnership, then you should own your career and figure out where you can get the right level of partnership.
Absolutely.
Awesome. And then last question I have for you, Newton, if people want to find you, reach out to you, connect with you, what's the best method for that?
A few things. So newtonchang.com. I give an overview of my bio as well as what I do as a speaker or a workshop facilitator. I am active on LinkedIn. And then lastly, on Instagram, you can kind of see how I live my life at this intersection of family, athlete, and leader in the workplace.
And I love how you introduce yourself first as like a dad, like a family, then as an athlete, and then work third. So I think you have the right priorities there.
Thank you.
Awesome, Newton. Well, thank you so much for your generosity of time. I'm glad that Darcy brought the two of us together, and hope to see you in person one day if I'm out there in LA or you're ever here in New York.
I would love that. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks a lot, Newton.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
The newsletter rocks. Check out the Accelerator, XLR8R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You'll get the occasional pet picture. And you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You are going to love the next one.